Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
What the hell? Let's do it.
That's the spirit. To quote the great Joseph Campbell, he said, "It is by going down into the abyss where we recover the treasures of life. Where you stumble, there lies your treasure." To the ironic twist of the unknown. Bottoms up.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Let's do it. Let's go down into the abyss for that treasure. The dragon holds our treasure deep in the caverns of the unconscious. And that's what we're doing today and always on AM Bite. My name is Miguel Connor, and yes, I am an alcoholic. 12 years now, friend of Bill, and I can't do it without my higher power. And indeed, that's a very Gnostic quote because, yes, through our higher power, our daemon, God, the one, the monad, whatever it is, as we find out our purpose, our treasure, and where we achieve levels of individuation. And that's why we are really here to heal the universe and to make everything united. So today's topic is very near and dear to me. And I'm very excited for it. And it's a very good book that I really enjoyed. And that is The Shadow of a Figure of Light. And our guest is Cody Peterson. Cody, thank you very much for coming on AM Bite.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Pleasure is all ours. And again, yeah, great read. You put a lot of things together and I learned a lot of things that even I didn't know about Jung. But then again, as we both know, reading Jung is as eternal as individuation, right? It never ends because he wrote so much and so many people wrote about him.
Yeah, that's true. I feel really really lucky, I think, to have been able to piece the story together the way that I did, because I don't think anyone had told it quite like that. So
yeah, no, it works, and it's a good read, as they say, it flows, and you get exactly what you're trying to do. So we will get into that, but first, welcome to the Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you doing?
I'm great this morning. Always looking forward to things about Jung, and I didn't know about the connection between Jung and AA, so interested in hearing about that.
It's a huge connection, and it's I learned it again for a book that both Cody and I read, David Schoen's The War of the Gods in Addiction. I read it a long time ago, and yes, a lot of in my Elvis book that's coming out in April, I tried to speculate why Elvis's addiction got him, and I do use Jung and David Schoen to understand the steps of, you know, how Elvis went down into the abyss and unfortunately never came out. So, great work when you connect Jung to Bill W., and that's what we'll do. But first, for the audience, as always, good to see everybody. Good to see Graham. Good to see you, Christina. Lovecraft, when you're here, I know the great old ones will stay asleep for a little bit longer, so keep them asleep until after the show. But they are archetypal images when you think about it. But yeah, if you have a question or comment or complaint against Vance and I, please super chat them so we can get to them. And that's it. So Cody, tell us about yourself and how you came to write this book.
Sure. So I'm a person who grew up in the atmosphere, I guess, of alcoholism and drug addiction. So I was enamored by the power of alcohol since I was a wee boy. And, you know, I struggled for years, as they say, going in and out of 12-step rooms, just trying to get a handle on things, and was eventually able to get clean and sober in 2012. So
me too. Congrats. Yeah,
thank you. Yeah, it's pretty. It's been great. And you know, so
the Mayans were kind to us that year.
Yes. Ah, yes, they were. I like that. Yeah. So I'd always known. You know, I mean, I did a little bit of college, and I've known about Jung from obviously. You know, Bill talks about him. Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, talks about him in his book, Alcoholics Anonymous, or the big book. And I love that you have a Joseph Campbell quote in the introduction, because in about 2018 and 19, I started to revisit Joseph Campbell, who I'd been introduced to in college. Mm-hmm. And then obviously Campbell's a Jungian at heart, right? And eventually, I guess Campbell persuaded me to pick up Carl Jung for myself. So I started with the book Symbols of Transformation because I liked the title. And then I think I read a few of his alchemy books right after that. I read Aeon, The Archetypes and the Collective Unconscious, and then Psychology and Religion. So I just kind of just piled them on back to back. And I don't know, eventually, like through that process, I've just felt compelled to start writing. I didn't know what I was writing. I didn't know what I was doing really. You know, Jung talks a lot about active imagination. You know, looking back, it would appear that my writing process has been, for me personally, a process of active imagination. Mm-hmm. You know, I was lucky enough to work with Dr. Stephen Herman, who's an author and a Jungian analyst in the San Francisco Bay Area. So he's the one that helped me to piece together this story. So he had sort of uncovered the story of Jaime de Angelo and Carl Jung. And then I was able to use what I knew regarding Roland Hazard to kind of really kind of make a narrative out of that connection that flows. But yeah, I always felt that this, you know, having really relied on the 12 steps for my life, and really almost learned to see the 12, the world, I guess, through a 12 step lens, I guess. I felt like reading Jung was just that he was commenting on this process that we are experiencing. Right. And so there's this sort of hand in hand relationship there. And I've always thought that if Wilson had reached out to Jung sooner than 1961, who knows what interesting studies he might have made on the 12th. Same with William James, right? They were both really interested in transformation. And I think in the 12-step fellowships, we have access to that transformation that's very appealing. And we know about psychological transformation. We're experiencing it day to day. We see people who get it. We see people who don't get it. All of this sort of information kind of distills for us and gives us an interesting, really perspective, I think, into the stuff that Jung was writing about.
Indeed, and well said. And yes, for sure. Well, yeah, you mentioned William James. Why don't we start there briefly? Because again, yeah, well, Jung makes it into the big book, but so does William James. And I didn't know that Jung had met William James. And as you write, James liked him more than Freud. And it seems that James came, obviously, as we all know, the idea of the mystic experience. And this kind of both affected Bill W. and Jung, right? The idea that humans can transform with a mystic experience.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so William James really is sort of the genesis of both movements, actually, the 12 steps and analytical psychology or Jung's process, because and Dr. Herman was, that's why I reached out to him originally, because he wrote a book about the meeting between Jung and James in 1909 at Clark University. And at that time, Jung basically said that he had lost his soul. And so he had been working with Freud for a couple of years by that point, and was just, he just, you know, that's Jung's words. He felt like he had lost his soul. And it seems pretty clear that he recovered, at least was set back on the path towards the soul stuff upon meeting William James. And James, you know, James was the kind of guy who, and I've read, you know, his biographies and stuff. he was obsessed with experiencing mysticality, right? Like in his personal life, it's the, he wrote about it all the time. He was always writing in his journal and telling his wife. And so that, it seems like that sort of that necessity of like seeking the spiritual stuff is what really caught Jung's attention, because immediately after he sort of gets placed on this different path and he starts going down a whole different search. And he tells us that in 1912, he was looking to discover his own myth, And so that was a decades long journey for Jung. And it actually would end up leading into the formulation of the 12 steps. So, go ahead.
No. Well said. Yeah. Before we get into that, I think a very important figure, and again, I did not know about this figure. I'd read him and sort of overlooked him. I'm sure most people do, and you mention him. And that's Mr. Jaime de Angulo. And that was, it's almost like later on after Jung had his soul experience and he was doing work and going to America, Jaime was, again, this brilliant scholar, right? Unfortunately, he was a lost alcoholic. It was almost like this was Jung's like first case study into what an alcoholic truly was, the frustration of having one in your life.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly, you know, Jaime's clearly an alcoholic. And he is a well-known figure. You know, he's supposedly like kind of the grandfather of the beatnik movement in San Francisco Bay. Nobody had really considered the fact that he was probably using psychedelic mushrooms. That was sort of a leap that was a leap that I made. And then I was able to back it up somewhat with, the information I pulled from Floyd Buckskin, that this particular tribe indeed does use psychedelics. So I think when Jung met Jaime in 1923, he was really drawn to the fact that this drunken Spaniard had really started to uncover the myths of this ancient tribe, which was something Jung had written about in 1921. So he was interested in this sort of what he calls the primitive mindset, right? Referring to sort of that sort of archaic instinctual drive that each of us has. He also calls it the thirst for wholeness, right? Later on in the Wilson letter. But so when he meets Jaime, I think he's really intrigued by this. And he also knows that Jaime is an alcoholic because Jung had actually started treating Jaime's ex-wife, who had recently divorced him. They had a kid. She was trying to get custody. And so Jung knew all about Jaime when they met, right? And scholars disagree on whether Jung was actually trying to treat Jaime or was just really being his friend because of the information that Jaime had about the ancient tribe. So either way, you know, what happens is they kind of kick off this friendship and it turns out. And, you know, the next year, Jung decides to come to the United States on a whim because he loved hopping on those big steamers. Yeah. And, you know, just where he wasn't getting mail probably and to just relax. And then when he gets here, Jaime talks him into going to Taos, New Mexico. You know, and he says that he was willing to kidnap him if he needed to. And they take an exciting road trip, right? I guess I've taken the road trip south from the Grand Canyon, down out of the mountains in Flagstaff. And then you just cross this big, wide open desert. And they were on Route 66. And it had just been constructed or was still being constructed. They were in a 23 Chevrolet or something. So they were just tooling along at 30 miles an hour. And it makes you wonder if Jung wasn't able to gather even more firsthand knowledge of what it means to be a practicing alcoholic, right? just like what you said. Yeah. Jung had contact with alcoholics. There had been a couple that had come to him for treatment before this. But with Jaime, it was a little different, right? He's really intertwined with Jaime. He's analyzing his ex, and they really have a relationship, right? And so, and I think he begins to piece together what it means. The case I make in the book is that what Jung learns from Jaime is the spiritual quest that the alcoholic is on, during the phase of active alcoholism. You know, it's not just an attempt to sort of mask trauma, right? Which is sort of that common, I guess, interpretation that people have. But for me personally, as an alcoholic and a drug addict, you know, I've come to recognize through doing so much work is that what I've been seeking the whole time was a connection to the mystical. Jung saw that in Jaime. And so he was able to start piecing together this sort of narrative that would build throughout his life. And that finally culminates in 1961 when he tells Bill Wilson, the alcoholic's craving for liquor is on a low level, the thirst of our spiritual being for wholeness. And so.
Very true. And it reminds me, the Elvis book is done. So now I'm doing a David Bowie spiritual biography. And he did the same thing. There was a period in the 70s where Bowie was really into cocaine. He was only drinking milk and peppers and doing coke. And that was when he was into this black magic and he was enamored by Nazism. He was out of his gourd for like 4 years. Mm. And when somebody asked him, well, why did you do it? He's like, well, I realized I was looking for God. It's a strange answer for the press, but we understand it, right? Part of him was still looking. He was, like the song says, he was looking for God in all the wrong places, but he was looking.
Yeah. And I think it's a testament to Jung's brilliance too, to be able to recognize that in an alcoholic, right? Mm-hmm. That was sort of what sets him apart. In 1926, when he finally meets Roland Hazard, the billionaire, who's suffering from alcoholism, he has the wisdom and the foresight to tell him, I mean, against like all intuition and everything. I mean, for a therapist to tell somebody who's struggling, like, hey, I can't help you. You need God, you know, that's not a very scientific answer. And it sort of flew in the face of everything that Freud had been talking about. And it's such a legacy that Jung was able to leave behind by recognizing that and then having the courage to admit it too, right? To humbly admit, I can't help you. You need something different. So
yeah, very true. For the audience who doesn't know, yes, Roland Hazard, rich guy, could not figure out drinking. And Jung, after treating him for a long time, says, no, there's no cure for it. Only people have a religious experience. And then Roland then went to his friend Ebby. Ebby was friends with Bill Wilson. And I love that in the big book, there's Bill Wilson is sitting there drinking his gin while his wife's working. And Ebby's talking to him. And Bill Wilson's like, yeah, give me that God talk. I've got plenty of gin. We can talk about this shit all afternoon. I don't care. And Wilson is rolling his eyes because, you know, he thinks he's going to be preached. And Ebby gives him, well, have you thought about a God of your own conception? And that's a huge light that went on, right? That's when Bill Wilson realized, oh, yeah, I got to make my own God image, right? And that changed Bill's life because of Jung, Roland, and Ebby, this idea that a transformation can save us from anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the thing, so to tie this back in a little too, so they take this road trip and they end up going to Taos, New Mexico. And that's where Jung speaks with Mountain Lake, the native, who kind of tells him about the native myths and stuff. And it makes Jung realize, wow, I still
have. And Jaime was the one that convinced the elders. They're like, who's this old Swiss guy, white dude?
Right.
Jaime's like, he's cool. Talk to him.
Yeah, he's cool. He can help you, you know? And yeah, but so what happens for Jung, though, is he does say that he found his own myth, his own personal myth, right? And then I find it this most interesting thread between Jung and then Roland is in 1926. So that's when they meet. And then Roland finally meets Ebby in 1934. So almost 10 years goes by. Mm-hmm. And then Bill Wilson, who's struggling to get sober and stay sober, and just like you said, he has this sort of awakening that, oh, I can choose my own conception of God. Right. And that's sort of the version, I guess, of this own personal mythos that sort of makes it through the ether and then emerges through Bill Wilson and the 12 steps. So it's the same. It has the same flavor as Jung's quest to find his own myth of meaning. Bill Wilson then comes along and interprets that to using a God of your own understanding. And that, like you said, it opened the floodgates. You know, Bill says, I've worked with scores of men who felt the same exact way, right? That we, and I think it's this sort of this Western, you know, as West, and Jung talks a lot about this, as Westerners, we sort of inherit this God image, right? Bill Wilson calls it the czar of heaven. And he says, I just couldn't stomach the idea of a czar of heaven. And I think not just alcoholics and drug addicts, right? But I think in Western civilization in general, we have a hard time accepting our own mythologies because they've been interpreted as these sort of historical accounts that, and there's this God that's out there that you're supposed to pray to or whatever. And this mythological structure just doesn't work anymore. We're too rationalistic. We're too hyper, you know, scientific. You know, it's like, where does God live in the universe? You know, point out the galaxy or whatever. And you know, some religions actually do think they know where the galaxy or whatever. But yeah. So then what happens is Jung makes a response to this mythological dilemma that the West is caught in. And then surprisingly, Bill Wilson is able to also come up with a response, right? Which is that, why don't you just use a God of your own understanding, right? And so what sort of emerges is this new, I call it, in Jungians call it a myth of meaning. And it's just a new approach to accessing these mythological symbols and frankly, that is much needed in the world today, you know?
Yeah, very much. Because even as Bill Wilson writes, he was living in this hyper-rational materialistic. It was almost as bad as today. I think we're more open, but it was pretty much all about reason, logic. And most of the people in Bill W. circles just had no stomach for the transcendent, for religion, for anything. So it was a hard,
absolutely,
they had to change their psyches.
Yep. You know, I think it's worth noting too, and I find this kind of struck me, was that this, you know, since 1920 or 1930, when Jung and Wilson were formulating their ideas, the world has changed. Right. There's been a few scientific advancements and stuff. I mean, quite a bit is changing. But, you know, theologically speaking, we are still exactly the same as we've been for hundreds of years. Right. In terms of the myth that we're trying to use. And so the myth, it seems to have lost its numinosity. Right. Yeah. That it doesn't, for the rationalistic mind, the myth doesn't make sense. And the idea, like Campbell talks about this, that to believe now carries this connotation that I believe in stuff that couldn't actually happen in real life. Like a virgin can't give birth. That's biologically impossible, right? So then the people of faith say, well, I believe it anyways. And it's, but the whole point is that there's meaning in these mythological stories that can be mined from within them, but we can't look at them as historical facts. Either positively or negatively, in my opinion. So, in other words, the person who believes in the myths as concrete realities has blocked themselves from the numinosity of the symbols, that transformative power, the same way somebody who doesn't believe in the myths for the same reason. Oh, these can't be interpreted literally. Why? What's in it? What use are they? Right? But it's that within the symbols, there's great meaning and great power. You know, and that's why Jung would say we need to cultivate a symbolic life and learn to mine meaning out of those symbols and out of our dreams, and thereby access a deeper, you know, really connection to the world and to the universe. And that's really been, for me, that's been a huge learning how to read these symbols. And thanks to Jung, you know, I've been looking at my dreams and stuff, and it really is a whole new dimension of spiritual transformation.
Or synchronicities, or understanding what archetypes are working through you. It's great. It's fun frustrating but fun because there's no end. It just keeps going. And yeah, and of course, later in his life, Jung would say, "I'm just not interested in curing mental diseases. I'm interested in the numinous." That's the He realized that was the answer to everything. That's the answer to all Buddha, Jesus, what they're telling. Have an experience greater than you. That's how we get through this.
Yeah,
and again, through the symbols and the myths and all that. So it's a great lesson. But so Bill W. then he found eventually with Dr. Bob in Akron, Ohio. Graham says he's from there. So one day I should make a pilgrimage. But they start AA. And of course, you and I know that, of course, the squabbles, there were still squabbles because Dr. Bob was pretty an atheist. So there was always this, how much God do we put into it? But it came out and it's influenced by, as we're talking, William James, Carl Jung, obviously St. Francis of Assisi, whatever Bill W., you know, the esoteric of the time that he had to draw upon what he had. But as you write in your book, there's always a critique that, but yeah, oh yeah, look at Cody and Miguel talking all this wonderful Joseph Campbell stuff, but where's the mythology in AA? Where is the rich symbolism and all that? And as you write in your book, oh, it's all there. It's the modern myth, the symbol, it's all there. Could you share with the audience some of this?
Sure. Yeah. So I find it, so I make this statement in the book and I feel like it does hold water. It's that the less adorned any religious statement is by symbolism, the more sort of overtly psychological it becomes. Mm-hmm. So that's why analytical psychology, for example, they'll eventually put you towards the symbols, but also they want you to look at your behavior. You know, like the idea is that I try to see myself more objectively. So and what I'm really looking for is what Jung called the shadow, is where I'm behaving in certain ways that I'm not fully aware of. Perhaps I'm a little bit conscious, but like ways that, like, for example, my wife is fully aware of, but I can't see at all. Right? That's a perfect rendition of the shadow. Yeah. And so and the myth is sort of this story that the psyche kind of creates in order to depict the relationship that's taking place behind the veil of our consciousness, right? And as those symbols start to fall away, it becomes more and more psychological. So the point that I make in my book is that if we can sort of recapitulate the 12 steps as a modern myth, and understanding that the symbolical film, I guess, that obscures the ancient myths has been somewhat wiped away. It's not completely wiped away because there are symbols in the 12 steps. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Wilson says himself, bottles were only a symbol, right? So the bottle is a symbol. The alcohol is a symbol. The higher power is a symbol. God, as we understand him, is a symbol. So the symbols are still there. They're just not quite as, you know, absconded, I guess, behind this mythological layer. And one thing I point out in the book, which really opened up this concept for me, was the fact that Bill Wilson, when he wrote the 12 steps, and also when he wrote the big book, the first word of the big book, like in the preface, is "We of Alcoholics Anonymous." Mm-hmm. And there was sort of this urban myth that 100 people had helped to write the first 168 pages or whatever, which you can, if you're interested in knowing the reality of that, there's a great book by William Shaberg called Writing the Big Book. It's a fabulous book. You may try to get him on your podcast. He's an amazing.
I'd love to.
Yeah, he's really good. And if you want, I can email you that information.
Yeah, please.
But actually Bill Wilson mostly wrote the book by himself, but what he does in the book is he creates this anonymous character, right? The "we" of Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. And that character right there then becomes sort of like the human character of the myth. So for example, like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, right? Because the way the myths are structured is we have human characters and then we have the gods, right? And so in the 12 steps, we are the human characters, right? The "we" of Alcoholics Anonymous, or the "we" of Narcotics Anonymous, or the "we" of whoever, whatever 12-step fellowship you're in. And then there's the higher power. So So there's still this dynamism between the gods and the humans, but it's just, it's not as quite shrouded in that symbolical language as the ancient myths are.
Very true. Yeah, very true. And I love that quote in your book, which I hadn't heard, where in Alcoholics Anonymous, even God is anonymous. He's still this mysterious force that we can't describe. And each one of us will create an image. Some people will be Jesus, some Buddha. Some people, I love some people said, my higher power is my dog, because that's the one being in the world that loves me unconditionally, forgives me, and sees the best in me. So whatever your higher power, humanity, this anonymous God. And yes, also to the 12 steps, Cody, sort of red pill moment, you know, studying a lot of Gnosticism, mystery religions, all that. And I realized, I used to think, well, who wrote these? Did they, you know, as always, you're trying to critique. And then I realized, oh my God, the 12 steps are like a mystery religion ritual, because it's exactly like they did in ancient times. You prepare, you go down, you meet your demons, which is of course the, you know, the fourth step when you've got to bitch about people and realize, oh my God, I am the demon. Then you've got to eat crow. So I realize it is a mystery religion that you go, you start, you go, and you keep going to cleanse yourself, go down into hell, go into purgatory, clean yourself, and then rise again and help others wake up. And let me see if my screen share here, I wanted to put it up real quick because I got the steps somewhere. Here are the steps. Can you guys see it? And for the audience, yeah, Bill W. and Jung talk about how the first three steps were really, much of it was Jung, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. Number two, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And again, four is you're meeting the demons, you're meeting the archons, you're meeting it. They're in your head and your mind, but they're there and you have to face them. Anything else on the mythology you want to talk on the 12 steps, Cody?
No, I think you nailed it. I think you nailed it. It really is a journey inward, right? That was all that Jung was really trying to get people to turn and go inward, because that's where, you know, it's very interesting that the problem, right, is found within, and so is the solution. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other way of seeing the world, which is the extroverted way, which is that the problem exists outside, and so does the solution, right? And what I find most interesting about that is that very often people who perceive that something else is the problem, or another person or an organization or whatever, very often, if they do have a conception of a higher power, that conception is also somewhere else out there. Mm-hmm. And so those two things sort of mirror each other, right? And I love that Bill Wilson, he figured out the antidote, or I guess it figured out him, right? Which was that he realized that we think our troubles are of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. And I think that that's a profound statement, because you can say the same thing about every single human, right? That their troubles arise out of themselves, but they very seldom will you run across the human being that actually believes that. Mm-hmm. And as we discover the problem within, then we begin to uncover this mystical idea that Jung was really hip on, and as well as Bill Wilson, is that the God also dwells within, right? That the eye through which I see God is the same eye through which God sees me. That's Meister Eckhart. Yeah. Yep. And so that mysticism, you know, it's kind of this. It's like a self-feeding kind of psychological feedback loop, right? Where the more I discover the trouble within, the more I discover the God within them. And it feeds into itself. And, you know, and that's what I love about the steps, is they lead us down into the darkness. Really where we do, we confront our own demons, our fears, our resentments. And then, you know, we discover more about ourselves when we do the eighth and ninth step, and we start to make amends to people. We get even more information about ourselves, right? The whole thing is to see ourselves from what what Carl Jung called the objective psyche. Instead of just this little subjective ego perception, right? Yeah. We're trying to see ourselves from the big mirror, you know, the cosmic mirror, right? And how do I relate to the world? How does the world relate to me? How am I approaching the world in harmful ways that perhaps I can't see? You know, all of that stuff. It's all real. In a sense, it's basic kind of psychology 101 stuff, right? You kind of cover the same stuff, hopefully, with your therapist that you cover with your AA sponsor, your NA sponsor, whatever. But it's, you know, I like the way that AA does it, or the 12 steps, in the sense that it really has this spiritual basis, you know? Yeah. And that's what I think we really inherit from William James and Carl Jung. So,
yeah, for sure. Vance, do you have a question or comment?
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Yeah, it seems to me that a lot of the problems seem to come from external orthodox religion being imposed on people, and therefore it's not their own. They can't own it. Meanwhile, if you're addicted, you're stuck in a loop, a small, tiny loop, like your gas pedal stuck on your car. And there's something has to be transcend that. And that's where the spirituality comes in. Something has to make you aware that it's your foot that's holding the gas pedal down. That's what's really stuck, right? So it's kind of fascinating, the whole history about how it came together. You know, so I'm very impressed by that.
It is a fascinating story. And, you know, you reminded me too, because I tried to approach the book in a way that perhaps people who aren't really, you know, steeped in the 12-step traditions can enjoy it. And I feel like I found the key when I read this little phrase in Jung, and I don't have the whole quote, but I have the first part of it, which is that compulsion is the great mystery of human life. And I think another way of saying that would be addiction is the great mystery of human life. And so all of us, though, are compelled. So I like the analogy of the foot on the gas pedal, right? And then the question is, whose foot is on the gas pedal, you know? And this is what Jung would say. It's that we want to say it's me, it's my ego, right? I'm the problem here. But Jung wants us to see a little deeper than that, right? And the answer to that question would be that the entity that really has its foot on the gas pedal is the self. And that self is sort of the goal, right? But it's also the impetus of all of these troubles that we get ourselves into. A reporter asked Jung near the very end of his life about his own conception of God. And he said that, for me, God is the name by which I designate all things which upset my conscious plans and intentions for better or for worse. And that's that for me. You know, if I look at that and I really compare that to my own life, then this, in this paradoxical way, I have to admit that God itself or himself or herself or whatever, that God was really at the core of my addictions and my alcoholism, and that God was the one driving that bus, right? And Jung says that there is a diabolical element inside of every human psyche that would lead us directly into the eye of the storm. And the reason is, right, because the ego, this thing that I think I am, it has this addiction of wanting to control everything. The ego suffers from a delusion of control. That's maybe how we say it in the 12-step world. The Jungians say that the ego suffers from a delusion of sovereignty. And in order to break down that delusion, the only way that can happen is for the ego to be absolutely convinced that it is not running the show. that there is something else that's deeper and bigger that's really in charge. And in this case too, I kind of make the case that I feel like drug addicts and alcoholics, they have a little bit of an advantage here because they do suffer from this horrible compulsion that's deadly. And so we're really forced to get real clear about who's in charge, right? So it becomes easier, right, for a suffering drug addict to turn it over, as you would say, versus a person who, they have their life together, everything's fine. They don't really understand that they suffer from the mystery of compulsion, right? That the compulsion's a little more obscured and hidden, and so it's harder to see. And it can take a lot of work to dig into that and figure out where those compulsions exist.
Very true. Yeah, and for the audience, we say alcoholic or drug addicts. Addiction is addiction, and there's a good chance all of us have some sort of addiction that most people can overcome. It could be shopping, sex, working out. I was reading, as I told Cody, Gabor Mate's book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. Such an intense but beautiful book. But he's a doctor, and he talks about being addicted to classical music. And I'm like, reading the book, oh yeah, that's like meth, dude. Yeah. But then he talks about spending $8,000 a week on classical music. He talks about leaving a patient who's having a baby to go shopping, leaving his son at the comic book store and going, oh, I'll be back in half an hour. And 2 hours later, he comes back with all these CDs. You know what I mean? He was addicted. So you can be addicted to this compulsion, can take you and manifest. Like you said, it's a symbol, Cody, classical music, gambling. It doesn't matter, but it can take over you. So I guess that's the other question. Maybe we can move on to the, if you don't mind, the alcoholic archetype. Do you agree, or what's your take with Bill W. and Jung when they're having a correspondence where Jung talks about there's an archetype of the devil, and this is destruction. It can be, call it Ragnarok, Kali, but this thing, it exists to enter you and take over your compulsion, and his job is to kill you. As they say, addiction is suicide in installments, and that's what it wants. Your destruction, destroy your family, your job. That's its purpose, and it gets into the alcoholic. Again, Gabor Mate, the way he was heading, he was going to lose his job, his family, because of classical music, but it's serious. So what do you think? I mean, do you think there is this destruction that goes into the addiction?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I think in general, the unconscious there's a part of it that is destructive. And I think that, you know, in 12-step fellowships, we're super, super clear about this. It's obvious, right? Like we see, I mean, how many friends do we all have who have passed, right? Who just couldn't get it. Yeah. And you know, we mourn them, and we understand that that could so easily have been us, right? And still could be, right? So we don't fool ourselves about the mystery of compulsion. But the destructive element, you know, there's so many things to say about this. I mean, for example, there's a great sort of mythological, portrait of this dynamic as well, is that in mythologies, I mean, we can just talk about the myth of Jesus Christ. You know, his father, whom he called love, the God of love, demanded his blood. Right. And so there's this sort of violent element that is really the defining factor of the psyche, right? That that the self, which is this unconscious energy that manifests in these mythological symbols, the self more than anything wants us to transform, right? And that it's willing to risk the collateral damage in order to bring that about. So very often that mystery of compulsion does become deadly. It's something that's not very easy to stomach. You know, I mean, this isn't pop psychology, right? Nor are the 12 steps popular religion. I mean, we're telling the truth here, that this thing could kill you. And that there is a price to be paid, I think, for this transformation that can occur. You know, I like the story of Jesus when he's speaking with Nicodemus. And he says, a man must be born again to enter the kingdom of heaven. And Nicodemus is a smart guy. He says, what's a guy supposed to climb back up inside of his mother to be born again? And Jesus says, no, but he must enter the waters of baptism, right? And be born of the Spirit, right? And what I find interesting is that the symbolical phrase of this baptism, right, which is that, so if it's what he's really saying is that a person must die spiritually first. That's the key. That to enter the kingdom of heaven requires a previous death. Joseph Campbell quotes Ananda Kumaraswamy by saying that no creature attains to a new state of being without first ceasing to exist. Mm-hmm. And that is the nature of this process. It's that we call it spiritual death. Sometimes we call it the death of the ego. But what's really being killed or killed off or sloughed off is the ego's delusion of control, right? And the self will do anything necessary to make that happen. Now, if we sort of talk about this in terms of the archetype of the alcoholic, I think the alcoholic as an archetype is a great modern rendition of an even more ancient archetype, which Jung called the trickster. And the trickster is a very old archetype, and it's connected to the shaman. And so in ancient times, and probably in modern times in certain tribes and stuff, the trickster was sort of this kind of goofy, dumb character that would get himself into all sorts of troubles and often would die, and it was dangerous. The trickster was the person who wandered out into the forest and didn't show back up for 3 years. And when they came back, they were a little beat up. You know what I mean? No. That's the trickster archetype. And very often in these cultures, the person who would have sort of embodied that trickster element would transform then and then become the shaman, right? And so what we have then is that sort of compulsive nature that would drive them to, you know, get themselves in trouble and hurt themselves and do whatever else. And if they survive it, right, then there's a transformation that occurs. And now this person is actually called to help other people make that transformation. And so that's the really the essence of the archetype of the alcoholic, right? Because what we see in the 12-step fellowships are people who have suffered from this delusion of control. They've come in, they've got clean and sober, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then they clean up their lives, and now they become these great sort of carriers of this message of hope. You know, I know, like me and my friends, we love taking meetings into detox panels and rehab facilities where people have just come off the streets, you know, and we just try to tell them our stories and hope to God they'll call, you know, and every so often one of them does call, and we can bring them in. We take them through the 12 steps. And then lo and behold, a couple of years later, they're the ones taking the meetings into the detox panels. And so that archetype of the alcoholic then, it really sort of demonstrates that process of from the trickster, you know, and then the transformation into the shaman, right? Where the wounded healer, it's the wounded healer archetype, right?
Right.
It's a beautiful process. And you know, one of the things that was an impetus for me writing the book was that I realized that, like, because I was able to talk to quite a few Jungians and therapists and stuff as I was writing it. And I realized that a lot of people don't really know what we're doing in the 12 steps. Most of the professionals think that we are just a peer support group. That's where it ends. But they couldn't be more wrong about that, right? There's something profoundly spiritual that's happening in the 12 steps. And the reason that they don't know about it is that very reason of that trickster shaman energy is because we all have our hands full in the 12 steps trying to save people's lives. And for the most part, we're able to reach those very same people that they can't reach, that they don't have an answer for that, right? And we do. So
Very true. Very true. Yeah. On a little side note, I was thinking, putting it out there, wouldn't it be great if somebody did a movie, like a buddy road trip movie with Jaime and Jung through New Mexico, call it J&C. And speak, you know, two different figures, the alcoholic, the proper Swiss guy. And it would be kind of a fun, raunchy comedy, you know, like Thelma and Louise, yeah. But for mystics or something. Just putting it out there, my imagination. Unfortunately for an alcoholic, it goes to strange places. But I think you said it too, part of your book, and it's always very hard for people to understand, still is hard for me to understand. You talked about helping others, and that's, we're getting into paradoxes and opposite forces. You know, how do you stay sober? You help somebody else stay sober instead of, and of course, you were talking about the devil. And in your book, you say, you quote, answer to Job, where yes, you've got the devil doing all this havoc, destroying things, upturning things and all that, but you also say he's the one person in the universe that has Yahweh's ear. Mm. He's the trickster, the court jester. So, but that's true. We have a union of opposites, and as you write, Cody, Jung was influenced by German idealism, Meister Eckhart, Nietzsche, all, and of course, Goethe, who was just the giant above all giants, who taught Jung about joining opposites and paradoxes, right? That's important.
Yeah, that is important. That is the thing, right? Like if Jung were to say that, you know, what should I do? He would say, you need to conjoin the opposites of your nature. Mm-hmm. And that really is, it's the essence of the 12 steps. You know, it comes in response, I think. And I think this is an important point too. And it goes back to what you had said, Vance, that this sort of orthodox religion has, and Jung was really, you know, keen on this, and he pointed it out so clearly, is that we have, you know, the figure of Jesus Christ is just absolutely impeccable. It's a figure of light. There is no darkness there whatsoever, right? And on the other hand, the devil has become this really diminished symbol that they've sort of tried to castrate and like take away the devil's power. And so what we have then in Orthodox religion is this extremely one-sided paradigm that doesn't really speak to the actual experience of men and women, right? And so as a result of that, we all sort of try to shove our own darkness kind of under the rug. But it ends up coming out, and it kind of comes out sideways, right? Which is, and Jung would say that the state of the world today is in response to the fact that they tried to diminish the devil. And so the devil comes out as the shadow element that we see in this crazy world, right? So I just think that what I find, I think that what's most compelling about the 12 steps and the reason they're so actually effective is that they answer to this one-sidedness, right? And we don't really try to, and I think Bill Wilson was genius for this, is that we're not trying to like get rid of our character defects to make us necessarily better people or anything like that. That it's really, it all sort of, it circulates around this altruistic movement, right? And that my deepest, darkest secret could be the greatest tool that I have to help you yourself save your life and get sober. And so rather than just pretending that the past didn't happen or hiding from those character defects, we try to put them to use and help other people to become more accepting of themselves as well. And so that's the way this coniunctio, Jung called it the coniunctio oppositorum. And that happens in the 12 steps through this process. And again, that it goes back to the trickster shaman, right? The positive and the negative, that both kind of poles need to come into the experience and form a part of our being. And that goes back to that archetype of wholeness, right? A whole person. So Jesus, Jung would say, as a figure, as a God image or whatever, Jesus is incomplete because it lacks darkness. And so the process of psychological transformation for a human being has to, it has to involve both sides of that polarity.
Indeed. What do you think, Vance?
Well, you know, one of the things I'm thinking of and listening to all this is that I think it seems like the 12 steps lead people to an awareness of others, just explained very simply, you know, and leading you to be aware of the hurt that you've caused. Because when you're stuck in the addiction, you don't, others don't even exist. The self is like a little tiny self-involved ball, you know, that there's just like nothing. And so spirituality in the greater definition of it is the realization that you're connected with others. And so that's one of the impressions I'm getting from all this. And, you know, Jung is, of course, all about that. And, you know, the ways we're connected, you know, through the archetypes, you know, that's the archetypes are things that connect us all. They're all our building blocks of experience. So that's what I'm thinking of. You think that's true, Cody? You think that's has any truth?
I think it's absolutely true. I think that it's part of this. You know, this self-centered ego, right? And this delusion of sovereignty, which is that I'm the only person that matters, that my opinions are always right, that, you know, like it just on and on. And so, and part of that, that ego collapse, you know, involves the ego coming to recognize that, just like you said, like we've affected people, that we don't actually have the answers, that we don't know how to get to there, wherever it is we're trying to go, and that we must rely on a higher power or a superordinate entity, right, to get there. So, and I think that's absolutely true. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's just like what Miguel said, you know, the one of the first things you tell like a newcomer is like, go help somebody, you know, like go help somebody. If you really want to stay sober, you need to go help somebody.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is that I may say things about Orthodox religion as being responsible for a lot of this mess because it takes away power from people and it injects their idea and their symbols and concepts onto people, which it's not their own. So it's hard for them to make use of them. But the Catholic sacrament of confession has a very big potential to, you know, go in this direction as well. You know, you have to have the priest hearing the confession has to be kind of an enlightened person themselves and not, you know, just into the total, you know, total shtick of the orthodoxy. But that's a place, it's secret, right? So it's anonymous. And it's an opportunity for the priest to give the person advice. And there's a loving and a forgiving there. And it's interesting that a lot of the offshoots from Catholicism dump that sacrament. You know, that I kind of see a parallel between the AA steps and the Catholic confessional.
Yeah, and the Catholic Church got it from, as they say, from the Manichaeans, if you would. And it probably even before this tradition has existed of getting it out and getting help too. Always reminds me, as you mentioned many times, Cody, the actor in the play. That was the first thing when I first sobered up, like, oh, that is so me. And Jung himself did say his famous line, "The experience of the self is always a defeat of the ego." It always happens. Your ego has to come on board to the bigger plan. And that's why I always like the myth of the Demiurge and Gnosticism, because you have this being that's born from Sophia comes into the universe and says, there is no God. I am a jealous God. There is no God but me. And he starts creating the cosmos and he just botches everything up, terrorizing humanity. And you realize, you know, Demiurge, if you just saw that your mother and the other gods are there, it wouldn't be a mess. And that's what we alcoholics do. We suffer from that egoic inflation, as you talk about in your book, Cody.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I love that myth of Sophia, and you know, that I'm digging into that stuff right now in my personal studies. Now that this book is published and I'm like, can take a breath and focus on my own stuff, I'm dipping into alchemy and Gnosticism, and I'm finding it all to be fascinating.
Yeah, it's endless with Jung. We're at the top of the hour. Do you have a little bit longer, or?
Yeah, I'm good.
You don't have to chair a meeting or anything?
No.
Good deal. Good deal. Yeah, the audience, and I'm seeing people in the audience talking about their sobriety dates. For anybody who says anything, congratulations. It's you've done so well. Stay sober today. I guess we should talk, about advice. We've been giving people advice. Something that I often talk with others is the idea of grace, because I'm sure you're the same way, Cody. You go, how the hell did I sober up? I still don't understand what happened and why it happened and why it's different from me, why it's different from you, why this step worked for me. But yeah, don't you think the idea of grace, it works with Jung, right? It's the idea that we allow the powers of the divine to finally take over.
Yeah.
But it's a mystery. It's a God's time, as they say.
Right. It is such a mystery. I mean, I've got a friend who was just texting this morning, and he just can't get it together, you know? And it's in the past, he's asked me, just tell me what to do. I'll do it, you know? And I wish that there was an answer. You know, it would certainly make the world seemingly less, you know, sad and destitute if we knew the answer, right? You know, the idea of grace and I think that there's a misnomer, I guess, in the 12 steps when we talk about how like a certain person who can't get it, they don't have the willingness like I do, right? And it's like, but that is the crux of the problem, right? Where does your willingness come from? Because that is the secret sauce. That is the magic. And I don't know where my willingness comes from, but the only answer I have, and it's not a sufficient answer, and it doesn't make sense. You know, it is a paradox, but it's that I was so willing to burn my life completely to the ground. And that sort of, I feel like my willingness to go all in terms of the addiction and sort of going all the way into the darkness is what allowed this sort of kernel of grace to develop and form that then could carry me, into the light. Whether that's true or not, you know, it's like, I mean, we do have this sort of collective wisdom, you know, in the 12 steps. We'll say, oh, go get done, kid. You're not done yet. You know, it's tough. It's really tough. You know, the Bill Wilson never suggests in the Big Book to stop drinking. He never suggests that. He does, however, suggest that you go try some more drinking if you're still not convinced.
And see how it works out.
Yeah. And that's, I think that small like snippet alone can go right over the heads of professionals and stuff. Right. But we understand the wisdom behind it. There were people telling me for 20 years that I should stop drinking. Right. Yeah. And it wasn't until I darkened the door of a 12 step, you know, fellowship that people told me, well, it might be good for you to stop drinking, but can you stop drinking? Maybe you can't stop. Have you ever thought of that? You know, and it's like, oh, wait, maybe I can't, you know, or whatever it is. There's a paradoxical, you know, I love what Jung says, that man cannot overcome the tremendous polarity of his nature except by submitting to a terrifying process that works him rather than he it. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the essence of this question of grace, right? Even in terms of step one, where we finally admit that we're powerless, right? And that step one can take 20 or 30 years to really play out. But we find ourselves both in the compulsion of the addiction as well as the compulsion that comes along with recovery, that we've submitted ourselves to a process that is leading us rather than us leading it, you know? Another way of saying this is that I don't actually take the 12 steps. The 12 steps took me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even Jung said, you don't choose ideas. Ideas choose you. So again, a lot of it is you just have to be receptive, as they say, open, willing, just, you know, that's where the meditation comes. Try to open yourself, empty yourself, and allow the grace, the God, your higher self, whatever you want to call, to start taking over your life. And it's a process. I mean, nobody's out of it. I still like to smoke cigarettes. And I understand sometimes when I go to the store, I know as I'm driving by, I was like, that was a complete compulsion shopping. That was bullshit. We did not need that. But I had the rush, the excitement of, ooh, I just bought this and I'm going to sneak it into the house. You know, at least I recognize my little trickster alcoholic mind it's never going to go away, right, Cody? You said, the devil and Satan, I mean, God and Satan ain't going away. They're going to be around.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the real for me was realizing that very thing, that trickster element, you know, whatever it is, my little dishonesty or my whatever the thing, how in whatever manifestation it's currently taking is actually that's the seed that can eventually sprout into a transformation. Mm-hmm. You know, and that without that element of darkness, There is no walking into the light.
Exactly. And even without the transformation, like with complexes in the shadow, what Jung said, we can't destroy our complexes. We simply outgrow them. We have to observe the darkness and bring it into the light. Just observe, watch yourself and your bad behaviors and the stupid things I think. You know, when I'm meditating, I'm like, oh my God, the thoughts coming out of my head, Miguel, are you serious? And then I laugh at them because I'm like, they're just thoughts running around.
Yeah.
And for the audience, Cody has a great section, which I enjoyed. I actually wrote it down and I'm actually working through them. And that's the law of spiritual dynamics. And you go through, everything we've talked about, the opposites, the listening, the understanding, everything about the alcoholic archetype. But as we end, it's interesting, how Jung was never very much into entheogens, was he? I mean, I think he said ideas are more intoxicating. I think that's what you wrote in your book. So he never came on board with the whole ayahuasca peyote stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't, you know, he didn't. I wouldn't say that he's supportive of it either, in terms of as a way of finding truth. I'm actually highly supportive of it. I'm clean and sober, so I don't, but that it's like that boat has already left, you know. I discovered so much from my using of drugs and alcohol and just the whole everything about it, you know, the trips to jail, the homelessness, the good times, you know, the bonfires and, you know, the LSD trips out in the forest. And, I wouldn't ever tell someone that they, it's everyone for their own. I think though that Jung's point is worth considering though, in terms of using these chemicals, I guess, for spiritual sort of enlightenment, which is that There is meaning certainly to be mined from those experiences, that if we can learn to really try to access the unconscious in our own life and look at our own mythologies from our own cultures, and also really try to examine our dreams, and try to see how the unconscious is trying to manifest through us, that we can actually access a deeper connection and a more integrative experience than we will by just introducing something from the outside. I guess that the real message here is that using mushrooms or using ayahuasca or using whatever, LSD, whatever it is, that is just yet another attempt at bringing something from the outside and trying to cram it in to make me feel whole and to make me feel better. Right. And in a sense, you know, the archetype of the alcoholic, that it is a symbol of that sort of acquisitiveness, mm-hmm. right? The idea that something else that I need to get it and bring it into me and in, you know, rather than looking for the answers that already exist in the heart.
Yeah. To each his own. I remember when first medical marijuana came out, oh my God, the arguments in the AA rooms. I thought there were going to be fist fights because nobody could agree. Well, you know, it's a relapse. No, it's not a relapse. If a doctor, yes, it, and it was just like, I was like, yeah, give it to us alcoholics to make something really more complicated than it should be.
Right.
But it's an issue. So, yes, we are getting to the end. For those of you out there, any last message for those who are struggling out there, Cody? I would say, yeah, there is a solution. Get help. I always tell people, if you want to email me, obviously you need a physical sponsor and physical meetings, but if you need help, I'm there. What advice do you have for those struggling or that might be looking for help?
I appreciate that. I mean, what I have to say is that I think for people struggling with either addictions or depression or whatever it is that there's something deep within the soul that wants transformation and that wants change. And that if we're stuck in those complexes and those ruts and feeling like there's no way out, it really is a testament that there's something more profound that's trying to really manifest through you. And so the only thing you can do is to hang on in those situations. And there is help available. I'm available. My website, if you go on my website and email me, I'll usually respond right away. I see it. It's just cody-peterson.com. You can, you know, my book's available there. You can also get the book on Amazon and stuff like that. I do. If anyone was interested, I have a WhatsApp group and I'm doing a weekly study group. So we're going through the book chapter by chapter and pretty fun. We get, you know, 75 or 100 people each week and we have a WhatsApp group. So there's a lot of questions and stuff. And, you know, it's been fun. It's really 12-step based, but we're digging into the Jungian concepts and, you know, cause Jung was great. He's got so much to offer. And so it's fun to look at the Jung stuff through the 12-step lens and to really try to piece out what it was that he was teaching. So,
well said. And yeah, and thanks for that. And for the audience, of course, it's on the show notes right here on YouTube or your podcast. I think my advice too that I help is beyond melt, you know, joining Bill W. and Jung has really helped me, especially with emotional sobriety. But I think it was, I don't know if it was James Hollis who said, sometimes, yeah, our depression and addiction is because we're trapped in our worldview. And one of the easiest things you can do is just change your worldview, you know, your God image, your culture, your family. We think we're going to disappear in a puff of smoke, but we won't. Our self will be there, but our worldview is what causes sometimes a lot of depression, our beliefs, and those can easily be changed. Find something else. So that's something that's helped me, or at least not being so attached to my worldviews, realizing they're just constructs. So, so also, any last remark, Vance, or question?
Yeah, I just have one thing to say. It's an old saying, you can't build a box bigger than the one you're stuck in.
Or as they say in AA, how do you know you've hit rock bottom? When you stop digging. So yeah, this has been great. And for the audience, yes, we actually have a show in a couple of days on also addiction, but addiction to religion and God on your worldview. So I think you'll enjoy it. But that's it. Thanks everybody for being here. Please support Aeon Bite any way you can. Subscribe, like, one-time donations. I take crypto, anything to keep these lights on really, really helps. And that's it. Vance, first of all, thanks for keeping us company on this meeting.
Oh, you're very welcome. My honor.
Thank you,
yes, and for the audience, I highly suggest you get The Shadow of a Figure of Light. I also David Schoen's the War of Addiction, the War of the Gods in Addiction really helped me. Gabor Mate's books on addiction are great. Cody mentioned a few, so there is help out there. But Cody, thank you very much for coming on the show. Really enjoyed it, and thanks for your time and all the work you've done.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. It's been a great time.
Pleasure is all ours. And yes, I'm going to finish with my tagline, which I didn't get. I got like Jung from the ancient wisdom when I simply say, write your own gospel, live your own myth. Take care, everybody.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.